A cautionary tale about how xenophobia and anti-immigrant bigotry led to the sack of Rome and the fall of the Roman Empire.
The book ends on a very somber note because I saw what happened in Alaric's age as being the start of something that was irrevocable. There was a real overwhelming sense for me that the Romans simply could not and would not muster the political will to change their behavior.
That's Douglas Boyne. We talk with him about his fascinating biography, Alaric the Goth, An Outsider's History of the Fall of Rome. Then we hear from Jim Walsh of Food and Water Watch about proposed legislation to ban fracking. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rihanna. On August 24th, in the year 410 CE, Alaric and his army of Visigoths mounted a sneak attack on Rome. They sacked the city and helped put an end to the Roman Empire. The Romans called the Goths barbarians. It was an ethnic slur and part of a xenophobic anti-immigrant culture, one that had replaced Rome's former promotion of multiculturalism. Distrusting the Roman narrative about Alaric, historian and classic scholar Douglas Boyne set out to write his biography from his subject's point of view, not that of his enemies. The tale he uncovered in his book, Alaric the Goth, has important lessons for us today. Well, Douglas Boyne, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, Alaric the Goth, you know, I was fascinated to read it because, you know, you kind of know the name. Somewhere out there, there was this guy, not sure exactly when, who was a Goth, and what was that? So it's actually a very interesting and timely, actually very timely book. I'd like you to start out by reading the first two paragraphs of the book so we get a sense of that timeliness.
Sure. A talented immigrant is denied citizenship by an unjust empire, and in retaliation, unleashes a surprise attack on one of its beloved cultural capitals, Rome. His journey from ambitious boy to disillusioned adult takes four decades, but by the time he dies in the 5th century AD, he will be remembered as the foreigner who forced the most powerful politicians of his day to think twice about who they called a barbarian. He changed history, and yet his version of it has never been told. His name was Alaric, and this is his story. Born at the river that divided two lands, he survived a border policy that separated immigrant children from their families, saw lightning success as a soldier, and became the widely respected leader of his people, the Goths. He also watched as his dream of achieving the basic dignity of citizenship slipped away during a time of political paralysis, a frustration that turned him into a champion for his people and an enemy of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, that's a great beginning to this book. And right here, you are making an implicit connection from this story to today. Is this why you decided to write this story?
You know, Francesca, it's such a you know, fascinating question for any historian, because, you know, what is that seed of interest or curiosity that grows into these books that we write? And for me, I remember in 2015, when I was starting the project, there were two kind of formative moments that really crystallized what it is that I wanted to do. The first was really kind of basic. I had just jumped through the hoops of writing a textbook on this period. And that was one of the driest, although challenging, writing experiences that I've ever had. I'm not You know, no one signs up to get into this business to say, I want to write the textbook. But it was an incredible honor. First of all, six of my peers had endorsed it. And so to know that I had a mastery of these centuries was really something that made me want to step back and say, okay, well, how would I pick the experiences that stood out if someone came up to me and said, well, what surprised you about what you'd just done? So I had that kind of, the first kind of thing that drove this project was just a really good overview of the landscape. And the second thing that drove the project, I remember reading a profile of a very famous writer, I'll say her name in a moment, in the New York Times Magazine. And it was a story about Charles Dickens's first visit to Ohio. And here you have this eminent novelist from the British Empire touring the Great Lakes and the Upper Ohio River Valley. And the point of the story was that he was incredibly dismissive, incredibly disdainful that anything cultured, anything of his level of sophistication could come out of this part of the globe. And the profile was a retrospective of Toni Morrison's career. And for me, when I read that, the way that people have just stereotype and look down upon what they don't know geographically, everything kind of fell into place. I knew that to make this period come to life, I had to look to the margins of it. And the Goths and Alaric, by extension, were the people that just immediately drew my attention because they lived at the border of the Roman Empire. They've been continually dismissed and caricaturized as kind of frightening outsiders. But there comes that moment when we have enough distance where we want to right the wrong. We want to go back and say, well, it can't have been as bad as Charles Dickens made it, or it can't have been as bad as the Romans themselves made it. Who is this person? And can we understand his perspective? Did he contribute something that maybe we're not seeing? So with an eye on today, I think maybe that might surprise most listeners. I was never really driven by the explicit contemporary parallels. I was driven by the emotional reaction of wanting to flip history inside out and do it justice where it hadn't had justice done before.
Yeah, you know, they say history is written by the victors. You know, in this case, I guess it would be the culture that Roman influence culture that continued. But so first, let's talk a little bit about this society itself. First of all, who were the Goths?
The Goths were a very mysterious tribe that lived in the northeastern frontier of Rome, which puts them in the modern nations of Moldova, Romania, southern Ukraine, and on the shore of the Black Sea. We don't really have an understanding of where they came from. There were many native tribes that lived in the area in the ancient world. And by the time the Goths were able to express their own history by the 6th century, 200 years after Alaric's day, they were writing stories that were very fanciful in imagining their own origins. The writer Jordan is one of the only Gothic writers whose perspective of where the Goths came from survives. And he has them fighting at the Battle of Troy, and he has them befriending Alexander the Great. And as historians, we know that all of these things are completely made up. There's no documentary evidence for the Goths as a community until around the 3rd or 4th century AD. So I think the best way to conceptualize them is a tight-knit native community, tribes, who lived on the border of an empire in a vast swath of land that was their homeland. And the trees, the willows, the marshes were the places where they educated their kids. And the huts that are now long gone and the stone houses that sheltered them from the weather or the places that they called home. So they were very unassuming people. And I think that's partly why they were looked down upon by their neighbors.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Douglas Boyne about his biography, Alaric the Goth, An Outsider's History of the Fall of Rome. Do we know anything about their language? Because, you know, Romanian is very influenced by Latin. And then, of course, there were the Huns who were the enemies of the Goths and came in. And I assume Hungarian comes from that.
The Slavic languages. Yeah, absolutely. I think the lasting presence of the Romans in Eastern Europe attests to the root of the Romance languages there. Romania, absolutely related to Latin. And, you know, you have these Romans like Ovid, the very famous poet Ovid, who unfortunately spent the last decade of his life in exile on the Black Sea, completely out of his sorts, out of his comfort level. But the Romans did occupy that space and leave a long-standing culture there. What's surprising about the Goths is that they did develop their own language independent of Rome. But what's fascinating is how it came to be written down. You know, many languages are lost. Many languages, especially of native or indigenous people, never find a means of expression that translate across borders. And what we know, in a very seminal moment of Gothic history, it was Christian missionaries from the Roman Empire in the early 4th century AD who came to evangelize the native communities. And one of them in particular had a very, very positive experience. He was embraced by the tribes. He took a Gothic name. We know him as Wulfila, which translates as little wolf. And he was really responsible for giving written expression to the Gothic language, so much so that the Gothic texts we do have today are letter forms that he devised, but also predominantly Christian or biblical texts because of the way religion was intertwined with the passing down of the language.
So Wulfila, I mean, is it a language that's related to the Saxons?
The Gothic language does show up in characters across wide swaths of Europe, and even as far north as Scandinavia, which would put it, you know, close to the Saxons. There's huge scholarly debate about to what extent these signs are evidence of Gothic migration or evidence of Gothic settlement. And it's tricky to relate the Gothic people as we know them around the Danube, farther flung evidence, just kind of scattered points of evidence that we have. So when we're getting back into, I think one of the things that I was fascinated about with this story as a biography was there are so many dead ends in the way the scholarship works across the landscape of Europe. There has been pages done on migrations and patterns and movements of people that get the scholarly community riled up because we don't really have evidence to make substantial claims. And I was looking at this and I was saying, well, do I really want to wade into a lot of these kind of uncertain topics? Or could we maybe scale it down a little bit and just work from one person's view out and then see what we get? And I found that to be a more satisfying way of telling the narrative because I didn't have to take this bird's eye view of things, and B, it really gave the book a point of view, which I think was compelling for me to keep writing.
And to read. And yes, I could go down a rabbit hole here, but I will pull myself back. But before we actually get to Alaric himself, now let's talk about the other side of the equation here, Rome, Roman society at this time. Tell us about Rome in the 4th and 5th century.
Rome in the 4th and 5th century was a really phenomenally wealthy, self-contented society. It was a society that I think is best captured for me. I grew excited by the stories of all of the ways in which the Romans entertained themselves during this time. I think sometimes when you catch people off guard, when you see them kind of relaxing, is when you really start to get an impression of who they are. And so the stories that we have of the time are people with incredible wealth and privilege taking their boats out around the Bay of Naples and telling their friends that they've gone to search for the Golden Fleece. And they had a kind of hyperbolic sense of their own like adventure and lifestyle experience. There are really amusing stories of dinner parties being held at fancy houses where the host will bring out all the food, and you know the guests are there waiting to dig into the fish that's just come from the sea and the pigs and the pies, and the host will ask his slaves or his household staff to measure the weight of everything that's being served and to write it down on tablets and to do it in front of all the guests so that the guests have a better sense of how expensive the meal cost. And you read these vignettes and you just can kind of see how uncomfortable it was if you were at the opposite side of the dinner table. You just wanted to dig in, and this person is kind of making a whole fuss about the meal. They were very centered on their own experiences. And that, I think, comes through in everything that you see them do.
Mm. A kind of sybaritic Roman exceptionalism.
It is an exceptionalism. I think that's a not unfair way to put it. There's a poem that is written in Alaric's time, an interview, Spoon River anthology of just an average Roman. And he lives in Verona, Italy. He's a farmer. And the poem is about his desire to never have to go to a big city. He grew up on a farm. He loves knowing that the tree outside of his house that he had seen planted as an acorn. And to him, city life with all of its foreign workers and different languages and different fashion displays, none of it appeals to him. He would just rather be content by himself. And I think that speaks to a self-image that does kind of think that there's a self-resilience, but also a sense that if I want anything, I can get it. We can get anything we need. And they never lack for anything.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with historian Douglas Boyne about his biography, Alaric the Goth, An Outsider's History of the Fall of Rome. You know, one of the interesting threads that you follow through here are the transformation of Roman society from a place, from a culture that made foreigners citizens, I mean, widely distributed citizenship throughout its empire, and welcomed the multicultural wealth of this empire. You know, people anywhere and everywhere could be a Roman. You call it, you know, you talk about the term Romanism. And then by the time Alaric comes around, it's almost flipped on its head in a way. So talk about that transformation. What happened?
Yeah, it's really sad in many ways to watch it happen. I trained in classics. I mean, that's my home discipline. But my research focuses on the end of the Roman Empire. And I usually tell that to people, it gets a laugh because they want to know why I'm studying the downfall of the civilization that I'm supposed to be really fascinated by and interested in. And I tell them it's because it changed so dramatically. I admire all of the points of Roman culture and classical culture that I think speak to its positive qualities, its multiculturalism, its multilingualism, its religious tolerance at its best, its ability to see beyond skin color at times, the facets that made Rome great in the first and second century CE, when it was engaging in a process of extending citizenship to people around and outside Italy, is a really phenomenal chapter in world history. And yet, for me, I found it very maybe just essential that what drew my attention was when it started to shift. And by the fourth century, the fifth century, that same impetus to want to be inclusive goes away. It is not a feature of Alaric's time. Citizenship is something that is rarely broached in political contexts, even as we see poets and pastors and people on the street work it into their daily lives. They can't not stop talking about citizenship, but they never do anything about it. And it creates really big problems, both for individuals like soldiers who might be expecting, foreign soldiers who might be expecting a reward for their service, but it also creates problems for cities that are attacked, cities that see riots and frustration from the foreign communities in them who are stigmatized. The Goths suffer an incredible outburst of violence during Alaric's day in Constantinople, when this fit of xenophobia leads the city's Christians to the local Gothic church, and they burn it to the ground because of something that they've been told might be happening or brewing within the Gothic community. So Rome did so many positive things that I think are worthy of attention, but it's that notion that when things go bad, should we look away or should we look more closely? And I've always been the type of researcher who wants to look at periods of extremism more closely, because I think we have to learn from them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in a period of extremism right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really shocking to me how much extremist thought pervaded this time. Religiously, we see the Romans kind of go off a cliff. Culturally, we see them just kind of wade into the morass of things that complicate life needlessly. And it's really just kind of shocking that no one ever stood up to want to reverse course. I think that's I shouldn't say no one. I mean, I think that's who Alaric was. Alaric was that person who tried to change things for the better. The thing that I think is so fascinating about him is that what we know Romans thought of him is that he sometimes seemed to them to be more Roman than he was Goth. And to me, that captures the sense to which outsiders are often fighting to break in because they love the place that they're trying to break into. And it's only at the last moment when people on the inside build the walls, erect the gates, shut the doors, that the person who would have, by any other measure, been one of them has to reevaluate his entire worldview and say, why am I doing this? Why am I bashing my head to be a part of a place that's not going to have me?
So tell us now about Alaric. Give us a little bit about his background and how did he end up, you know, joining the Roman army?
He is, to me, an incredibly paradoxical character, and I think that's what drew me to him. I like his contradictions. He's inherently contradictory, and I think you see this. Much of his early life is missing, but what we do know that you know, when he comes on stage, when we see him in the sources, he is a hothead, you know, 20-year-old, and he's buried in the mud and the muck of Macedonia. And we know that he's trying to take down a Roman caravan. I mean, this is, you know, he is an insurgent par excellence. I mean, he's angry, he's mad. You can just see that he wants to kind of stir up trouble. What's just so amazing about his trajectory is that he's so good at planning, and he's so good at rallying people to his cause and being charismatic, that after this failed attempt to bring down a Roman caravan, within a year, he's a Roman soldier. We know he's a Roman soldier within a year of this event. And that, I think, sums up everything you need to know about him. He's a brilliant mind and probably a great friend and great leader who the Roman generals and commanders saw as a valuable asset to them. And for the next decade, he worked as a soldier loyally for the Roman Empire until a very kind of tragic moment. Many of his fellow Goths were slaughtered in a battle that I think he interpreted as a needless waste of life. And that was really the moment that caused him to start to reevaluate whether it was right for him and his people to be seen as so disposable.
So what did he do?
I think, again, speaking to his patience, he tried to work it out. We know that after 394, which is when this famous battle takes place in the Alps, he goes to Constantinople because he's heard word that one of the politicians in charge is a Gothic ally, that there's this kind of smart Roman named Rufinus who has decided that he likes Alaric and he wants to keep Alaric as close as possible. And there might be some money, there might be some funds to help him and some of his soldiers and their families who need support. So Alaric goes to Constantinople to see if he can find a way to continue his relationship with Rome. And of course, this is when events beyond his control really start to shape the choices that he makes. The Roman politicians in Constantinople are incensed. Conservative Block is incensed that there would be this man in the head consular chair trying to do outreach to foreigners, and they arrange for his murder, Rufinus's murder. So the moment that Alaric thought he had to kind of smooth things over becomes the kind of second strike against the Romans in a way that he instantly turns aggressive. He instantly turns angry. And over the next 2.5 years, there are reports of cities being sacked in Greece, which is where Alaric had been waiting out the events in Constantinople. And we hear stories of Romans in Greece growing very afraid by this kind of rising force of violence. How much of it can be substantiated? How much of it is Romans legitimately fearing for their lives versus simply fearing the prospect of a foreigner who is fighting for recognition? We can't sort that out. But by the end of his time in Greece, he even then was willing to meet with an official of the highest rank to talk about maybe potentially being on retainer or reserve if the Romans needed him in many ways. There are some geographic intrigue that's all taking place around this because the places where Alaric is going are really kind of divided in between the Eastern Mediterranean and the Western Mediterranean. And the Romans are having this kind of feast of gerrymandering at the time to figure out who and which palace is controlling which plot of land in the in-between areas. And it just so happens that at that point, the Eastern Empire comes through with an offer for Alaric that they would promote him, and he takes it. And this is 397 into the early 400s. And I think if we stopped the story there and just said, here's this boy who grew up kind of hating the empire, eventually becoming a soldier and working out his differences to get a promotion. That's an incredible story that almost speaks to the Rome of yesteryear, but it didn't stay on that trajectory.
Douglas Boyne. We continue our conversation with him about Alaric the Goth after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon or on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with historian Douglas Boyne about his fascinating biography, Alaric the Goth, An Outsider's History of the Fall of Rome. Let's pick up where we left off before the break. He must have been quite a charismatic leader.
I really do wish we had more of his speech and that we had even more of the writers who would give us a view of his character when he was not in negotiations, because negotiations didn't often go his way. So he's often described in the sources as displeased or sick to his stomach or marching out of his tent. And I think these are very understandable emotions for someone who is not being treated fairly. But I think there's a whole range of experiences from his everyday life with his wife, for example, or with his brother-in-law. These are steadfast supporters. They're at his side throughout everything. And even the families, the Gothic families who are homeless and following him around because they see him as their best chance to improve their lot, they must have had a connection to him. I mean, I think he must have, if he spoke to them eloquently, or even if it was just a look in the eye, I really wish that we'd had something that would have helped me bring that out more, because I don't think become so widely respected as a leader unless you have that quality.
And Douglas Boyne, you just mentioned the Gothic families who are homeless. One of the big points you make in this book, Alaric the Goth, is that he was a refugee, as were so many of the other Goths. What were they a refugee from?
Yeah, it's a painful time when the Goths leave their home in this era. There are two historical forces that are responsible for leading them across the Danube River, the Danube being the northeastern frontier of Rome. And one of the forces is external to Gothic life. The Huns from Central Asia had increasingly started raiding the northern parts of ancient Gothia, the Goths' homeland, and it has made it very unstable. Life is very unstable because of these incessant horse-driven raids. The second thing that we see kickstart this movement of Goths away from their home is civil war. There is very clear documentation of the tribes in, especially closer to the Roman border, going through an intense period of intertribal warfare in which politicians can't really decide about how much they want to be allied or working with or collaborating with the empire to itself. So between the internal war that's devastating the Gothic homes and the external raids that are starting to make life just generally economically untenable, by the end of the fourth century, we hear the numbers in antiquity are upwards of 200,000 people crossing the river. There's, as with any number in antiquity, going to be a debate about that. But the Goths have a very distinctive clue that they leave behind that we can at least use to make their experiences more real. They brought their own pots, and their pots are not Roman made. They look different. Archaeologists are very clear about studying the color, the clay, and we find them all over the Gothic homeland. And after the fourth century, we start to find them in Rome. So there's a very clear kind of trace of this migration of refugees, but also a migration of people looking for more opportunity. There were many reasons why people went to Rome, and I think the Goths fit all of them. But certainly by Alaric's time, many of them who have come are looking for stability. They're looking for work. They're looking for house. They're looking for a paycheck in Roman coin, as it were, not to be too colloquial. And the Roman system is largely not set up to assist them. And so their day-to-day existence is scrappy. They need to beg. They need to, you know, sometimes need to steal. These are the things that instantly arouse many Romans' ire about having them in their towns, near their markets. And the stories are horrific about how they're treated. There's one in particular of fathers would go out for a walk, and they would be befriended by a passing Roman soldier with a kind of congenial invitation to dinner. And their families would never see them again. Gothic families would never see their fathers or husbands come home from those invitations. This is the refugee experience.
Right. And also they took the kids, little kids, 7, 8 years old, and sold them into slavery.
Yeah, the slave trade was endemic at the river. And then when relations between the Romans and the Goths were kind of at their worst, the emperor had this political idea that if the Gothic children were going to come to Roman soil, they should be separated from their parents in the event that if they grew to maturity, they might become bitter at their new homeland. And so the emperor arranged for them to be sent hundreds of miles from the Gothic border. We don't have any documentation about whether they saw their mothers or their sisters. Again, I think that was really the point. The point was to take the children and to remove them from their homeland experience, as a way to start to inculcate them a sense of loyalty to Rome. The program ended disastrously, and I mean, it ended with all of the boys being murdered.
Yes, it just such a terrible, terrible story. And so we can't talk about Alaric the Goth without talking about the sack of Rome. So why did he sack Rome, and how did he manage to, you know, get into this highly fortified city?
It was an incredibly fortified city. By the early 5th century, the Romans had already built a huge circuit of walls around their city. There were 13 gates on one side of the river alone. Rome is famously divided by the Tiber. And by the early 5th century, the politicians were convinced that the best thing that they could do in an environment of such uncertain relationship with migrants and refugees was to double the size of the walls. So the big investment project of the early 5th century is to double the size of Rome's defenses, which currently puts them at the height that they are today. And within 4-5 years of that moment is when Alaric is staring at them. So by 408, he's staring at these large defenses, and he's really out of options for whether the empire will pay attention to him or even respond to wish list for the Goths. So he starts, I think, small. He starts with a blockade at the harbor to make sure that any food or supplies coming in and out of the city would be commandeered and stopped. And is remarkably effective. means of getting the Romans' attention. His first appearance in Rome ends with negotiations with the senators about whether they can help him. And I think that's a really fascinating moment in the story of the sack of Rome, is that we are less than, at this point, less than 2 years away from this world-defining date. And the Roman senators are bending over backwards to try to help Alaric in his plight against the emperors. What you're seeing, I think, is a very clear political division between several of the senators who understood what the smart political response would be, and the imperial house, who was detached and intransigent about responding to any of the wishes. The senators tried to help him. They are as unsuccessful as he is. And by August of 410, he's back outside the city of Rome. We don't know how he planned it. We don't know. The last we hear of him is really, I think, May or June of 410. And so there's a gap of about 2 months or so before the end of August, where in the book, I describe some of the things that he might have done during that time. And the things that I at least describe during that time are the Romans' daily patterns and the Romans' generals' handbooks for describing how to plan an attack. And the handbooks that the generals used of the Roman army were unanimous in saying that reconnaissance was key to staging a sneak attack, and that sneak attacks were smarter against walled cities, in part because you never knew the ingenious devices that a military could turn back on you as a countermeasure. There are tales of Persians pouring pitch on people. The Persians at one point gassed Romans in an attack. The Romans themselves dropped large wooden wheels from the walls so that they could roll down and take out attacking horses and soldiers. There were any number of countermeasures that would easily be put into place if someone tried to foolishly make an assault against a walled city, certainly a walled city the size of Rome's. And so during June, July, the Romans are on, or into August, the Romans are on vacation. They shut up their houses. Their stores are covered with shop front slats. And there's just largely a desire to escape the heat. Rome in antiquity in August is always described as torrid. And I think this was really the time that Alaric took advantage of when they come back to their routines at the end of the month. He's been able to, I think, observe which gates have sentries that he might be able to quickly overcome. And what we know is he snuck in through one of them. It was the middle of the night. He may have had help, but the rest unfolded on the streets afterwards. It was an unassuming start to a very cataclysmic 3 days.
So I'll leave it up to our listeners to you know, read your book to find out more about the sack. But I have one final question, which is you study the end of a civilization that the American Empire has often been compared to. What are your thoughts on, you know, I mean, empires rise and fall. I don't think they go on forever. From the standpoint of the history that you know of the Roman Empire, what are some parallels and or differences that you can see with our own situation? And do you feel that, you know, we're a civilization that's moribund or about to fall? We have some even more cataclysmic threats than the Romans did, such as catastrophic climate change.
Yeah. I think these questions are really helpful. I think they lead people back to times in which, you know, we try to control for as many variables as we can, and then make you know, comparisons or hope that maybe emotional episodes leap out at us. I think the book ends on a very somber note because I saw what happened in Alaric's age as being the start of something that was irrevocable. There was a real overwhelming sense for me that the Romans simply could not and would not muster the political will to change their behavior. And this was really sad in many ways, knowing that the city and its culture were almost 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years old by that point. It's a remarkable story of a culture kind of growing tired with itself. And I think, responding to your question, I think I answer it myself differently than I presented it in the book, which is I am hopeful and I'm optimistic that America is really young. And America has, I think, so many communities who right now are just finding their voices. And we look at, for example, the Confederate statues being taken down. We're just beginning to have the debate about what should go in their place. And to me, the artistic side of me, my mind runs immediately to which amazing new artist is going to have the chance to put something in our public spaces that reorients our public conversations to the future that we want to live in. I think we still have those opportunities, and if we fight for them, to be able to make the world that we want to live in more inclusive, more sustainable, better grounded, and more equitable for everyone. The impression I had of you know, watching Alaric's death and then just seeing the decades that came immediately afterward was of a society that had just given up.
Well, Douglas Boyne, it is a fascinating story that you tell, one that has not really been told in this detail before. Alaric the Goth, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real pleasure.
Douglas Boyne is professor of history at St. Louis University and the author of several other books about late antiquity and the end of the Roman Empire. Watch the book trailer for Alaric the Goth and find more resources at writersvoice.net. Joe Biden's climate plan has been hailed by activists as the most far-reaching policy proposal to tackle the climate crisis by a presidential nominee. It was developed by one of those joint Biden-Bernie Sanders task forces and included key members of the Sunrise Movement. But as I covered in an online-only segment on the Writer's Voice website in July, there's something important missing from it: a fracking ban. And there's a proposal in Congress to remedy that lack. Let's take a listen to an excerpt from that segment. Joe Biden has come out with a $2 trillion climate proposal that climate activists say goes in the right direction, but isn't enough. In particular, they call out the lack of a ban on fracking in the plan. But there is a plan currently in the U.S. House of Representatives that would plug that hole, H.R. 5857, the Fracking Ban Act. It was introduced by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, in February. To find out more about the Fracking Ban Act and the reasons for it, I called up Jim Walsh, Senior Energy Policy Analyst for Food and Water Watch. He provides policy guidance and support to local, state, and national policy campaigns that help to ensure a just transition to 100% renewable energy by 2035.
The Fracking Ban Act is an important piece of legislation that actually seeks to address a major gaping hole in the national energy and climate discussion that's going on in Congress and largely across the country. And where states like New York have taken steps to ban fracking, nationally, the larger policies that are being put forward by the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, as well as presidential candidate Joe Biden's plan for climate, all largely ignore the supply side of fossil fuels. And this is really critical because we know that if we don't stop the development of fossil fuels, we are going to continue to see the climate crisis being moved forward. And so where we're seeing plans being put forward to develop clean renewable energy and the prices on clean energy moving forward, that is actually increasing the amount of renewables in the grid, we're actually seeing the amount of gas growing even more significantly. And so if you look at the over the last 20 years, coal has declined by about 22%. Over that same period of time, gas has actually increased by 15%, whereas solar and wind have only gone up by a combined 6 to 7%. And so we know that simply transitioning to clean renewable energy will not actually result in elimination of gas. But worse yet, the plans being put forward aren't actually advocating for clean renewable energy. What they're advocating for are policies that will use terms like carbon neutral. And these sorts of policies put a lot of false energy and climate solutions on the table that would compete directly with solar and wind. And so those are aspects like biofuels that come from particularly from factory farms where they're actually capturing methane in digesters. And then what's happening in many states in the Northeast, particularly with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, is that those factory farms are actually able to get subsidies because utilities pay them for capturing that methane as a climate benefit. But then the utilities that are paying them for that benefit can actually use the credit that they get for purchasing the essential reductions in CO2 to continue increasing pollution in the atmosphere rather than actually reducing their own emissions. And so these plans are actually not only not addressing the supply side, but are actually doing things that will allow more dirty energy to be included in our generation system for our electricity, which is very concerning.
Actually terrifying. There was a report very recently in the last couple of days saying that methane emissions have increased quite a bit. And methane is it's short term, but a much more potent greenhouse gas, even than carbon dioxide. This bill would phrase out fracking, you know, hydraulic fracking for oil and natural gas. What does it say about pipelines that right now are being built? Even, you know, in New York State, there are fights happening right now to try to stop the building of pipelines, and even if New York State itself has banned fracking.
Exactly. And so that's the continued build out of gas infrastructure, even in places where we're saying that we aren't going to do fracking or we're increasing clean energy commitments. We're continuing to see this gas infrastructure being built. And what this is being driven, and it's not just pipelines, but it's also power plants. And the Fracking Ban Act would actually prohibit new fracked gas pipelines and power plants from being built to ensure that those entities are not taking place in our energy system. And, you know, you look at states like New York, the policies that exist there are still leaving the door open for dirty power and pipelines, even with these clean energy standards. And if you look, the Dan Shanker power plant now is pushing for an expansion of their power plants. And they're actually greenwashing themselves by essentially putting forward a program that says that they will actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions by increasing the amount of gas that's actually there. And they do this through a really convoluted way of saying that by using renewable natural gas and relying on this dirty energy source from factory farms, they'll actually reduce the carbon footprint. This is a really big problem in general because, one, it supports the development of these factory farms and dirty energy systems that are being built out from these factory farms to create new revenue streams for waste. But it also continues to allow for gas plants to be built. And those gas plants aren't just releasing CO2 in the atmosphere, which is warming our planet, but it's also releasing particulate matter, PM2.5, ozone precursors. These are things that literally kill people and make people sick. And so transitioning our energy system in a way that will support a A true, just, and equitable transition will not be one that continues to burden our communities with air pollution as we're transitioning to clean energy. So when lawmakers and Congress and elsewhere are talking about these clean energy plans, the fact that they're neutral on the generation source is really problematic. And the fact that they don't actually address the fossil fuel infrastructure is equally problematic, because when you look also beyond the pipelines, the fossil fuel industry is working to build out petrochemical infrastructure that will increase our plastics. They are working to build out infrastructure to expand into global markets to increase the amount of methane that they're selling into global markets. So this is the industry's hedge that is set up to make sure that they can continue to profit and continue to move forward with business as usual, even if we move forward with a plan to achieve clean renewable energy 100% from the sun and wind sources. And so this really is one of the reasons the Fracking Ban Act is really important, because none of the major policy recommendations in Congress right now are actually looking at how do we address the development of gas infrastructure and the impacts it's having on communities. And, you know, in states like New York, where you've banned fracking, that was largely done because people recognize the direct impact it has on drinking water, on local air quality, and other impacts. There's been numerous studies that document the proximity to fracking wells and lower birth rate and infant mortality rates increasing due to proximity of fracking wells. And so we know that these facilities from start to finish are causing significant public health concerns, but we are not developing an energy plan that will actually phase these things out and phase out things like fracking, but actually developing an energy plan that may very well institutionalize fracking into our clean energy system. And so, and I use quote fingers for clean energy in that manner, because we all know that fracking gas is not clean, but the industry continues to claim that it is.
Jim Walsh of Food and Water Watch. There's more to that interview at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.